So I can't tell you the stories because it's his story to tell and not mine. Here's what I can tell you about our speaker. Kind, thoughtful, great listener, great contributor to Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, open-hearted, and above all, he is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'd like to introduce to you Michael.
My name is Michael, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? All righty. God, it's really good to be here today. It's always grateful to be in speaking in front of AA and Al-Anon. And I really want to thank the committee for asking me to speak here today, and especially Charlotte and Glenn and Diane and Don and all of the people that, you know, been a part of this roundup and being of service. You know, I just really, truly love to be here. And when I was 17, I knew that I had a drinking problem. And I thought I still had a choice to quit. And I'll step back and show you how I got there. You know, when I was, I grew up in Moorhead, Minnesota. I had a nice family, and except for my mom's side, they were all crazy. But I'll tell you more about that later. But we had a house in Moorhead, Minnesota, right next to Fargo, North Dakota. They do speak like that in the movie, by the way. And we rented out our basement. We had a lake cottage at a lake in Minnesota, Land of 10,000 Lakes. And we would go there every weekend, and we would go, you know, skiing, and it was great. And my dad's best friend lived right next door, and he owned a golf course, so we'd go golfing, and it was just, you know, roses and sunshine back then. And I remember my parents, they used to play cards later in the day, and they would drink, and, you know, I was a little kid, I'd be sneaking the drinks, and every now and then I'd get a cigarette butt in my mouth, but, you know, I'm like grabbing the drink and pouring it down, and it was cute, you know, and my parents thought it was cute, and they'd go out at night, and one of the memories from my mom was that she would cut up a stick of butter before she'd go out partying, you know, and she would take that whole stick of butter and swallow it to coat her stomach. And that's the kind of family I came from. We get into it. And that's the culture of drinking. My whole family and relatives, we really thought about this stuff. And one time they went out partying, and I snuck a bottle of vodka, and I remember just getting so sick. And I think I was 6 years old. And the next day I was throwing up, and again my mom and dad were patting me, you know, and they thought it was cute. And, you know, and I thought, I'm never going to drink again. This is crazy. Why would anyone want to do this? And then fast forward, you know, later on, you know, and I didn't have any anxiety. I didn't have any fear. I didn't have anything going on in my life at that time. And then later on, when I'm 13, 14, I had, you know, anxiety in my life. I don't know where it came from. I got, you know, probably from, well, first of all, I was a kid, and I was prematurely born, had a black patch on my left eye, and I had big, thick glasses, and I was that kid in the front row that always would raise their hand. I got the answer, so I got bullied a lot, you know. And so at 13, 14, I remember I had anxiety about, you know. And I remember one time someone asked me, who's the front four of the Minnesota Vikings? And I didn't know, right in front of the whole class. And I know today, Paige, Marshall, Eller, and Larson. And that is so crazy, but... And I remember I was at this party. It wasn't really a party. We were having a retreat in an Episcopalian church in the basement. And I wanted to ask this girl out, Penny. And I was so nervous. And someone snuck in a keg. And I started drinking off that keg. And everything changed. And you guys know what I mean. The fear, the anxiety, everything disappeared. And I asked that girl out. And these people at... I thought were enemies of me or now my friends, and I knew at that point in time that alcohol would be a big part of my life because it just made me feel whole and complete. And then fast forward into high school, I was 17 in high school, I had smashed two cars, hit and run, disorderly conduct, assault on a police officer, grand larceny, you know, and I'm a good kid. I don't, you know, these things are kind of like, they were, you know, it's really about perception, right? You know, in my mind, I'm just like living my, you know, childhood years, you know, to the fullest. And to my parents, they didn't see it that way. And I remember one time, you know, from a driving, let me just tell you one, here's how I drove. I was going to high school and we'd party at night. And there was a street about a mile from my house, it curved, and I blacked out one night. And I hit the car on the side of the street. And that's kind of a jolt to wake up from. And I told my buddy, hey, go get all the pieces out of yellow Trans Am. And I said, throw them in the trunk, we'll get out of here. And so we did. We got out of there. And I was working at Shields Hardware at the time. And the next day I had to work after football. And I got called into the vice president's office. And I'm thinking, God, he's going to recognize how hard I've been working. I know that. And I get in there and he said, sit down. And he takes and throws a piece of my car and hits me in the head. And he said, the next time you run into my car, make sure you get all the pieces. And, you know, and I was a good worker, so I didn't get fired. But, you know, and I'm a good learner, though. So I got the car fixed, and 2 weeks later, I black out going the other direction. And I hit the car across the other side of the street. But I'm a smart guy. Didn't hit and run this time. I went up to the house and said, you know, I hit your car, I'll pay for it. So, you know, that's my kind of learning. You know, and my mom was very similar. She went through the windshield of her car at 58. And instead of going into AA, she said, you know, I'm going to quit driving and drinking. You know, and so our family was kind of like that. But I knew at 17 I wanted to change. You know, I saw the people, I saw the lifestyle. You know, and I didn't want to live like that. I wanted more for my life. You know, I really wanted to. I didn't like the shame. I didn't like the remorse. I didn't like the going into work and, you know, my boss throwing a piece of car at me. I wanted more out of life. So I decided I was good in math and physics, and I decided to go to college. And so I went 2 years at Morehead State University, and then I transferred to Madison, Wisconsin, and I became a nuclear physicist. And then I got a job in fusion research. So I was doing that. And you know, and I'd really kind of done a geographic. I'm not going to drink. I drank a little bit. I controlled it, you know, and I thought I was doing a good job. And then that guy that worked with me at the Fusion Research Laboratory, his name is Tom, actually Tubier Tynan. And he said, Mike, we're having a party at the Sigma Chi fraternity. You should join us. And I knew inside that was a bad idea. I just knew it was a bad idea. But I went there that night. And, you know, I'm the kind of guy that drinks till he blacks out. And that night I blacked out, and I was lighting matches, and I still to this day don't remember, but I guess I was lighting matches and throwing them into this girl's hair, trying to light her hair on fire. And the problem was, it was the president of the fraternity's girlfriend. But as it happened, she had cheated on him that night, so the next day I got voted into the fraternity. And I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. But here I am now. You know, it's like my priorities changed. You know, and that was the problem with me. I wanted to do good. I wanted to really be that good employee, that good student. But I loved the excitement. I loved the romance of drinking. I just loved it. And, you know, so the next 3 years, I eventually graduated. But it was like I remember, you know, taking, you know, I'd put beer in my, you know, because the pledges would, you know, kidnap us and take us out of town on a retreat. I loved doing that. It was crazy. And I worked in the fusion research laboratory. So one time I borrowed this laser, and I had my buddy go inside the church. And when they say, you know, God, show me a sign, throw your hand out the door. And I fired the laser through that church, and I had the whole congregation outside. You know, we had so much fun. It was just crazy. And now we were sponsored by Budweiser because we had the Budman that lived in our fraternity, and we had the mascot of the Wisconsin Badgers. So we had, you know, we'd go through 28 kegs a weekend. It was crazy. With like little palm trees in the basement with sand. We were all into it. And of course, I worked in the fusion research laboratory, so I'd bring home grain alcohol, you know, and you know, it was just a mess. But, you know, I look back, you know, there was I saw a lot of tragedy. You know, people getting, you know, just not, you know, I'd be going to class, you'd come home, there'd be people hammered at 10 in the morning, you know, playing Monopoly. And I just think, that's not right, you know. But here I was, you know, doing my thing too, you know. But eventually I left there, and, you know, and I went, I didn't even know what a nuclear engineer did. I was just, because I didn't really care. I was just partying and studying. I never really had a much of a self-awareness. And I went back and I went to, you know, live with my parents to go for my master's. And, you know, and I got to tell you one other thing, that that best friend of my dad's that lived next to us at the lakes, well, my mom had married him. So, you know, so that was kind of a mess, you know, in our family. And so I went back there, and he didn't like me because he wanted control of the family. And I remember one time coming home, and I remember when I was young, he had me pinned on the floor around my neck, cutting my hair because he didn't like my long hair. So he was kind of a mean drunk, you know. And I remember one time they came home from a party, and he started, my mom locked the door, and he was kicking down the bedroom door, and the rage came up in me. Just the rage of, you know, me getting bullied and all that feeling. And I pulled a gun on him, and I said, you know, if you go through that door, I'm going to shoot you. And, you know, there was no bullets in it. I wasn't dumb. But it didn't really help our relationship, I can tell you that. After that, it's, I knew, and 2 weeks later, I got a DUI. You know, I'd always been a good, you know, and careful, except for a couple, you know, hit and runs and stuff like that. But I got picked up by the cops, and I got a DUI. And then 2 weeks later, I got picked up with no license, you know, because I had a spare license. And they checked, and I didn't have a license. So I knew then my time was running out in Minnesota. And the kicker point was and I love my mom. My mom is a saint. But she said, Mike, I'll drive you anywhere you want to go. And I could just, and I was teaching college at the time, mathematics, and I could just see my mom pulling me up to college and getting out. And it was just the humiliation would have just been too much for me. So I decided to come to California. And there was a friend that went to high school with me, so I just thought I'd come out there and get a job. And so that's what I did. And in fact, it's really interesting. The way I got a job at Xerox was I hung out at the bar next to Xerox. You know, smart thinkers. Never go in the front door, go in the side door. And so I hung out there and I met people, and then eventually I got a job there. And I loved that place. I loved the work. I had transferred into software, and it was fun, and, you know, and I wanted to be that good employee, and I started out, I said the right words, I did the right things. And then, you know, but on Monday, a lot of times I couldn't make it in. And eventually I never made it in on Monday. In fact, 5 years into my sobriety, here's how it was. I was a procrastinator. I didn't like conflict. So what I would do is, I knew on Sunday night I wasn't going to go into work. And so what I would do is I'm going to call in the morning, but I would miss the mark, and I didn't want to talk to him. So I'm going to wait till lunchtime to call in and tell him I'm not coming into work. I would miss the mark. So I call him at 8 o'clock at night, telling him I'm not coming into work that day. So all of that anxiety in my stomach, it carried into my sobriety. And for the first 5 years of my sobriety, my stomach hurt on Sunday night. And so it took me a long time to, you know, I was a mess. And but here I am. Where am I? Okay. So here I am working at Xerox. And, you know, and pretty soon Friday got hard to go into too, you know, because I was excited about partying, that it still was working a little bit for me. And then eventually I was going out with this girl at Xerox, and this is kind of the end of my run. She asked me to go out and get a bottle of wine. And I said, sure. And I figured I'd pick up some accelerants too to go with that. And I went over to my accelerant dealer, and I didn't go home that night. I didn't go to sleep that night. And I didn't call my girlfriend. And the next day, I didn't go home that day either. And I didn't go to bed. And I didn't call my girlfriend. On the morning of the sixth day, I hadn't gone to sleep. And I hadn't called anyone. And, you know, I knew that it wasn't probably a good idea. I knew that I was messing up, but I just kept on. I couldn't stop. Once that physical craving was so strong, and the mental obsession, that I just couldn't quit. And on the morning of the sixth day, I was hungry, and I opened up the cupboard to get something to eat, and there was nothing there except the bottle of Grand Marnier. And I remember pouring that down, and my body went into grand mal seizures. And I remember call 911, and this girl said, "I don't think so." And she took her shoe off, and she stuck it in my mouth, and she dragged me into the other room, and she said, "Work it out." And she shut the door. And I remember laying there I was confused. I was crying. My body was just in pain. But I remember that foxhole prayer, "God, save me, or take me, but don't leave me in the middle." And I didn't die. Maybe a little brain damage. I don't know. But, God, I was scary. And I would like to tell you that I quit, drinking and using that night, but I didn't, that line in the big book, I just got to read it. It's so crazy. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect it produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it as injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. And that's what it felt like to me. So I went back to work. And even though, I quit drinking for a couple of months, and even cold, stone sober, sitting in the burning wreckage of my life, my mind will tell me a drink is a good thing to have. And that's what it did. After a couple of months, my mind said, "Hey, a drink would probably relieve this stress you got going on in your life." And I went on another run. But this time I tried to commit suicide because I couldn't see an out. I could not see an out. And I remember writing a letter to the LA Times, just saying no, blah, 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 and all this stuff. And what happened was I was sitting there and I saw my sister telling my niece that Mike's gone, and it broke my heart. So I once again, I'm foxhole prayer, "God, don't let me die. I don't want to die." And the next day I went to the Alano Club. Went there and went to that morning meeting. And I started my journey of sobriety. I went in there and I eventually got a sponsor. And, it's so funny that first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that my lives had become unmanageable. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. Now, that first step, I was pretty sure about. I wasn't quite sure my life was unmanageable. But that first half of the first step, I was definitely. And later on, it would prove that my life was unmanageable, too. And I needed a power greater than I believed in God. I really believed in a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I did make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I got into this. I knew what to do. I was a good student. I could study these steps. But what's interesting, once you get sober and the physical craving leaves you, I thought that was I'm the physical craving's gone. I didn't realize that the mental obsession is in full effect in my life. And so what I did was I started working the steps, and I worked that third step, and I that job that I worked at, I kind of got laid off. They didn't see the potential in me anymore. And I didn't like people to work 3 days a week. And I, my sponsor at the time he got me into service work. He said, "I need some help cooking for the South Bay Roundup." And so I went over, he looked like he needed some help, but it was a trick. That's what they do to you. They trick you into service. And so I got into service, and it's interesting because it was the breakfast for the South Bay Roundup, and I met my wife. She wasn't the wife at the time, but it was my girlfriend, and we've been married 29 years today, And, it's what a journey. I really appreciated that panel that talked about, intimacy in marriages because thank God for Al-Anon, because if it wasn't for Al-Anon, we wouldn't be married today. And I ended up starting I didn't start a consulting company right away. I burned through my 401ks, which is not a good idea. I started a consulting company. Me and Christy started dating, and I started working the fourth and the fifth step, or the fourth step, with my sponsor. And I remember doing my fourth step, and it was amazing because I saw all the causes and conditions in my life. I didn't realize that Most of the things that happened in my life were around alcohol. All the bad things. Except that kids arm I broke in fourth grade, or the teachers arm I broke in fourth grade. I was not drunk. And I was shocked. I thought it was just situations, and I didn't realize how much alcohol was a part of my life and a part of my culture. And you know, and my everyone on my mom's side was dead. You know, my cousin blew her head off, or the other one robbed a bank and blew his head off. And it was just a lot of, you know, they used to wear ankle bracelets. I thought they were in fashion, but that was my family. You know, and. But I didn't want that life. I wanted to change. So, you know, and it was really interesting here. So after doing a fist up, I saw my causes and conditions. And I realized the obsession now that I started consulting and I was in a relationship, I realized the character defects that I had. I was not a good employee, and I was not good in a relationship. But I wanted to change. I wanted to change. And I remember my first 10 step. I got a consulting job, and this guy told me something to do, and I said, who are you to tell me what to do? And he said, I'm your boss, I quit. And I was so arrogant. I couldn't stop myself. I couldn't stop my mouth. And what happened was I left that job, and I was driving down the 405, and the guy that got me the job said, oh, are you nuts? He said, if you don't go back there and apologize, I'm never going to get you another job again. So I turned around and went back and apologized, and I don't know how many 10 steps I did at work. That was hard, but it wasn't as hard as the character defects that I had in my relationship with my wife, that we eventually got married. And but you know what happened was I associated money with freedom. You know, so I got into the steps, but it wasn't my priority. What was my priority was money, making money so I could become free. I came from a relatively poor family. And what I was taught was you work hard, you make money, and then you become free. And I lived by that bondage, or that belief. And so I got into work. I was a workaholic. And the more I worked, the harder it was at home. In fact, my wife thought I had eventually got married, but my wife thought I had an affair. I did it with my laptop. I was always working. And you know, at 10 years, I got into problems. I got into a lawsuit with my company. We ended up winning, but we ended up losing. I don't get in a lawsuit with your only client. So I won the client. I won the lawsuit, but I lost my client. But what happened was, someone had told me, if you don't change your consciousness, Mike, you're never going to hold on to anything. And I never knew what that meant. Change my consciousness. What are you talking about? You know, and it was interesting because I saw Christy now started meditating more, and I saw the calmness that it brought in her life, and I wanted some of that calmness too, and so I started meditating, and after this lawsuit ended, you know, I shut down my company, but what it did for me was I realized I had to change my concept of God. This God that I had was heaven or hell. I'm getting punished if I do the wrong thing, and I'm a flawed individual. I have a lot of character defects. You know, and it's interesting, you know, it says in the 12 and 12 in step 7, our self-centered fear is the chief activator of all of our character defects. And that's what happened. I had so many little fears, and what it forced me to do was to control my environment so that I could be at peace. Because really what I wanted was I wanted to be comfortable sober. And I knew that if I couldn't stay comfortable sober, that I would drink again. And I didn't know that. But I just wanted to get comfortable. I never felt comfortable in my life. You know, I always had this anxiety. And so, but what it did was it forced me into the work. I took classes, you know, little relationship classes, spiritual classes with, you know, to learn how to have better relationship. And I started reading a lot of spiritual books because I wanted to change. You know, I wanted to get better. And I don't even want to say better. I wanted to rewire the way I thought, my perceptions, my beliefs, because that's what was driving a lot of the things that I did. And, you know, it's my belief in, you know, materialism. I thought materialism was so important, and I realized that, you know, ultimately it's my inside that's going to, you know, manifest the outside, not vice versa. But, you know, it's interesting. You can tell that to a newcomer, but you got to experience it. You got to experience it. You got to get that thing that you wanted and realize it doesn't fill the hole inside of you. And that's what happened to me. You know, eventually I went back to working and in our relationship, you know, and still I was working a lot, and I ended up taking this job at this video game company, and we ended up creating this, you know, video game that became number one in the world, and, you know, it was crazy, and I was working more and more, you know, and eventually I found out my mom got cancer, you know, and I left that job, and after 7 years, I started there when there was 10 people, and when I left there was 2,000 people. You know, we and 1% of the world played our game on a weekly basis. It was crazy. But I wanted to spend time with my mom because, you know, there was times when my mom would come out and visit me and I would be working, and I remember seeing pictures, and where am I in that picture? And Christy would say, you were working. And so I quit work and I went back and spent months with my mom, you know, and I remember just walking with her. You know, it was really interesting. You know, our family didn't talk. There was no owner's manual like, this is how you live life. We sat and watched I Love Lucy at dinner time. You know, I didn't know anything about my dad. I didn't know anything about I knew more about my mom, but nothing about my dad. You know, nothing. And so when he died, I didn't have the connection. But when my mom was sick, you know, it just like, she was always there for me. You know, when 12 cars showed up at my house, she was there. You know, when I needed money for college, she was there, you know. And so when she got cancer, I remember, you know, sitting on her deathbed and telling her, Mom, you don't have to worry about me anymore. You know, and that was, it broke my heart, but it was, I'm so glad I was sober to go through that, because if I wasn't sober, I would have never even gone back. You know, and so I got to do that. And about that time, and then I came home and you know, and now that I wasn't working, I was... Like someone else said in the last panel, here I am with Christy. We have all this time. And, you know, it was interesting. It was like we got to get to know each other again. And we started, you know, dating and doing all these things. And I remember I had a resentment against her for not, you know, making enough money. She became a school teacher and worked for 19 years as a school teacher. And it's so interesting because she was a great school teacher. I remember, in fact, it's so interesting because some of the things she taught to her little kids, I said, I could use that for myself. You know, developmental psychology and all these little techniques and you know, and what I mean by that is that, you know, a kid would be running on the pavement, and they would say, a bad teacher would say, quit running, Johnny. And she would say, hey, Johnny, I like to see you like to run. How about if we run over here on the grass? You know, and I'm out golfing, right? Par 5, I have a nice drive, second shot, right before the trap. I just got to flop it onto the green. And I flip it into the trap. And I'll say to myself, you idiot. And, you know, and I quit doing that kind of talk to myself. You know what I mean? That self-talk, you know, it's so interesting because for so many years it was like, everything was good or bad instead of just journey of, you know, transformation. You know, we come to this program and we have this material consciousness, or other people call it self-consciousness. And what it is, it's a transformation to God consciousness. You know, how do we change in this program? You know, going through and working the steps and realizing that, you know, this is going to transform us. And I didn't if I would have got what I wanted, I would have sold myself short because I didn't know what existed. I didn't know what existed. You know, I didn't know that if I came in here that this is going to transform my life and I'm going to build a community around myself. I didn't know any of that. And so here I am now. We're back home and me and Christy, you know, I've always gone to a lot of meetings, and I got into, you know, I love my home group in Hermosa Beach and you know, sponsoring guys, but I'm at home now, and I got this other opportunity to really make amends to my wife, you know, and to really see that, you know, all of the things she created a home for me. You know, I made some money, but she created a home, and when I went back for that year, I started, you know, shopping and cleaning, and I realized, oh my God, there's a lot of work, I didn't, you know, I took all that for granted, and it was like, oh my God, and we started to love each other again, you know, and it was amazing. I remember when I did my 10th step with my sponsor had me do my 10th step, and in fact, when I got sober, I had this stack of letters from the IRS. I never opened them. I ordered them by color, though, and when I got sober, my sponsor had me open them up, and, you know, and he said, you know, you got to start paying this money back. And I said, well, it doesn't really make sense for me to start paying this money back till I have the money I can pay back. And he said, no, we're going to start paying, you know, $5 a month. And then when you get a better job, you'll pay $10. And you'll just keep on increasing that till it's paid off. And I didn't see the significance of that, you know. But, you know, what it did was it got me in the process of paying money back and being responsible for my life. Because when I got sober, I remember when me and Christy moved into with each other, I couldn't get my credit was so bad, I couldn't get a bottled water stand. You know, like a $30 stand on credit. They said, sorry, sir, your credit's too bad. For a $30, it was probably worth $4. And I was so pissed. I was chasing the guy up this driveway. Don't you know who I am? You know, but so paying that $10 back a month, you know, over time, I ended up paying the student loans and the IRS back in 10 years. And, you know, I never thought that would be possible, but it was such a freedom, you know, of paying that money back and just doing that amends. And I remember, I want to talk a little bit about amends, because I remember making amends before my mom died and dad died, I did amends to my dad. And he said, well, why didn't you just quit? You know, and my mom just loved me so much. She was just happy that I was done drinking. They don't know that we really didn't quit, that alcohol left us. If I could have quit, you know, I would have done that. I wouldn't have needed Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and you know, it's just the process of recovery is amazing, you know, and I have so much more compassion today when people go out, because I realize they are doing the best they can, and that's just their journey. You know, when I first got sober and I saw people, you know, drink again, I would just say, God, you just got to be stronger. You just got to have more willpower. You know, I didn't know what I didn't know this disease like I know it today. You know, that when it gets us, it gets us. And, you know, we do the best we can. But, you know, and ultimately how I stay sober is by keep on working the steps, by staying in the middle of this program. I want to talk a little bit about my spiritual journey. You know, when I got sober, I wanted to get sober, but it wasn't the most important thing to me. And like I talked about, you know, I got into meditation, I started changing my concept of God. And ultimately what I realized is that this whole thing is about God. And you know, people ask me, what do I do today? You know, it's just love and service, you know, and go to meetings and sponsor. I sponsor a lot of guys. And you know, I just started a group online where, sometimes the sixth and the seventh step are kind of flyover steps, right? We go from the fifth, and then we go home and spend a half hour, and we jump into the eighth and the ninth. And what I started doing with some of the guys that I sponsor is, at night when we review our day, let's identify a couple areas of conduct, you know, that we want to change. And so we're reading Drop the Rock. You know, I love reading books online with guys. I do this all the time with different, I'm in a few of them, and sometimes unapproved AA literature, but Drop the Rock is a real good one. They go over the sixth and seventh step. And so we're identifying a couple areas that we can change, and then we're putting action items on. We're holding each other accountable. So every week we read a little bit of the book, and then we talk about, you know, hey, did we follow up on those things that we need to do to modify our, you know, our conduct that we're trying to change in our life. And only a couple conducts, not all of them, you know, because if you try to focus on all of them, you're not going to get anything done. And, you know, it's been really amazing. I love working with guys. I love seeing the, you know, the lights come on, you know, and I just, you know, it was like a month ago, I got four sponsees, you know, in 1 week. And, you know, one guy's on the docks of Long Beach. You know, and this guy is so hungry for the program. He calls me all the time. He wants, he does the, you know, we're going through a 12-step step guide, and he does the questions, and he just loves it. It's his fourth time through the, you know, the book, and This, you know, the other two times he ended up drinking again, and when he drank, he goes to jail. And so the staying sober is so important to him because he's married and he has kids. And he doesn't want that life, but I love people that are hungry in the program that work the steps, that really want this. You know, I wish when I got sober, and it's funny because that was not the way I was when I got sober. I did the bare minimum. I did the bare minimum because I really thought that I knew better, like I've always thought. And so, but it took a lot of humility to realize that all of the little paths I went on in life, and I took this journey, and my spiritual journey was after that company went down. I got into a, you know, this Church of Religious Science, and I started reading all these spiritual books, and I was studying under Michael Beckwith. I'm going to become a practitioner, and I'm going to become a religious man, you know. And it was really, it was interesting, my journey there, because, you know, end of the day, you know, and I thought that was higher than the 12 steps. I thought it was higher. It had more, you know, I'm going to spend all this time and I'm going to get enlightened, you know, and it's so crazy. And my whole journey's brought me back to AA, you know, and that's the, it's such a spiritual, you know, I'm reading this book about this priest who started he's not even an alcoholic, he started a 12-step program, you know, a group, because it's where he finds his spirituality. And, you know, being a priest, it's hard because how do you talk about some of your fears and all this stuff when you're, you know, a priest, people think you're on this pedestal. And so I find that AA is such a spiritual program. It's the only place I know that we're all aligned in this common solution towards, you know, recovery. But in the end of the day, we become honest, open-minded, willingness, all these character traits that we're constantly growing and learning. And I remember after I left my hometown, I went back, and some of my friends that were still drinking were still at the same bar, on the same seat that when I left 4 years before. In fact, but after I left, I used to call him, yeah, can I talk to Scott there? I know he's sitting on the second chair in the bar. You know, and I'm so glad that I was able to leave. But it's something, you know, after 32 years of sobriety, it's something that I find. I love what Sandy Beach says. The more time I get, the more I got to bring God into my life, because I'm bringing him into more areas of my life. You know, I look at that first step today, you know, my lives have become unmanageable. And I love the third step because it's I made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God into all areas of my life. And I got to bring them into all areas of my life because ultimately I don't know what the right solution is. I don't know what the right outcome should be. But I know that if I keep on focusing on the moment, on this moment, not on the future and not on the past, that everything's going to flow perfectly. And I just have to be there, be of service, and bring love and harmony into this situation. So that's what I do today. You know, I decided to go back to school. I'm going for my master's at Stanford in AI. Just because I'm curious, that I want to keep on studying, I want to keep on growing, I want to keep on learning, I want to grow spiritually. And so I love this program, and I love being here today, and thank you very much.